So this talk is called The Levels of Going for Refuge and the Great Stages of the Spiritual Path. So there's one more talk after this tomorrow, so we're getting near the end of the series. You'll be pleased to hear. So about 2 years, I think it was, after I was ordained in 1978, I attended my first ever order convention. This wasn't the first order convention there had been. I think there had been two or three conventions before that convention. I mean, the first one was in the front lounge of Ariyatara Community. You could get the whole order into one room. It's probably about the size of one of our lounges at the front of the house, I think. You could get all of the order in that space. And then I think there were others in a church hall in a place in North Norfolk, a village hall somewhere for a few days, and then one in what's now the London Buddhist Arts Centre. It wasn't then, over a few days. And again, you could get, you know, most order members in quite a small space, or a fair number of them. And in those days, order conventions, Bhante would just talk a lot about, you know, his vision of the order and the movement and what was going on. And, you know, you could have those sorts of discussions. And they were all noted down by people. We've got actually records of some of those meetings, and they're very interesting. But in 1978, Bhante suggested something different. He pointed out the word convention just meant coming together. And it was held at some school, I think, in Sussex, and actually it was more like a retreat, with Bhante leading everything. I mean, there were some talks by order members, but he led the meditations, he led the pujas, he led us every evening in a visualization meditation, different one each evening, and he gave, I think it was three, you know, long, substantial, and I think very important talks, actually. Which have had a long-term effect on the history of the order. And those three talks were, first was a talk on the levels of going for refuge, a system of meditation, very important talk on a system of meditation, and a fantastic talk called A Vision of History, which is a fascinating talk, because his vision of history is a vision of a war going on between the group and the spiritual community. And he had quite a lot to say about spiritual communities through history, including quite a bit of evocation of the Manichaean community. Anyway, I'll leave that with you to look up. But it was very inspiring, you know, being able to be around, you know, Bhante at that time. And I found all of those lectures not only very helpful, but, well, they formed my own, you know, understanding of what we're about. You know, you listen to something, you know, when you're, what, you know, how old was I, what, 21 or something. I mean, they have it has a sort of formative effect on you. And I think it was the first time we'd heard him put together the levels of going for refuge and a system of meditation. I don't think he'd actually done that before. And you can see how Bhante gets to his thinking about the levels of going for refuge in that booklet, The History of My Going for Refuge, which actually I think is a very important work, very subtle work actually, but well worth reading and rereading. So today I want to explore these levels, but I also want to do something else. I want to relate them to another teaching from the 70s of Bhante's called The Great Stages of the Spiritual Path, which emerged in a seminar in 1976 held here on Nagarjuna's Precious Garland, which was actually Surita's ordination retreat. Surita was ordained on that retreat, and his public ordination took place where the tea bar is. So it's a very sacred space there, the tea bar. And the teaching of the Great Stages of the Spiritual Path relates to the material in a system of meditation, but it looks at it slightly differently. It's a much more general application of those ideas. Anyway, we'll come to that. And you can see, actually, when you look at the seminar, it's quite interesting to see the way Sangharakshita was in those days, because he was a much younger man. And, you know, there he'd been expounding in this seminar, Nagarjuna. And then one day he comes in and he says, I've been thinking about what's really needed in spiritual life. And he just spontaneously kind of came out with this, you know, very pithy set of, you know, precepts about the stages of the path that just covers a page. Brilliant. You know, the Dharma kind of happening on the spot. So it's quite something to see. But anyway, let's look at these levels of going for refuge. So there's the cultural going for refuge, the provisional going for refuge, the effective going for refuge, the real going for refuge, the ultimate going for refuge, and the cosmic going for refuge. And we'll be focusing in particular on effective. Effective, I've put effective and real here, but it's actually effective, and it's actually going to be provisional and effective, I think we'll be looking at mostly. So, but let's just remind ourselves. So first of all, cultural going for refuge. So this is the going for refuge of a born Buddhist. It's a custom. It's not really living any kind of serious spiritual life. You might be a thief, you might be a murderer, but you still do the refuges and precepts. This is not saying... He's not saying, Sangharakshita isn't saying, that all traditional Eastern Buddhists are just ethnic Buddhists. He's not saying that. He's not saying that there aren't Buddhists in the East who've grown up in a Buddhist culture and so on who aren't seriously going for refuge, effectively going for refuge, and other levels of going for refuge. That's manifestly not the case. But what he's getting at is Buddhism as a cultural habit, if you like. You recite the refuges and precepts, but there's no attempt to practice. You do it because that's what everybody else does. That's what the nation does. It's tied up with your identity as a Sri Lankan or a Thai or whatever it might be. And we, of course, can slip into this. We can find ourselves just kind of going through the motions, having all the words, but not really living it. Not really doing it. All the cliches, we can pour them out, we can recite the refuges and precepts, but we're not really living it. So it is possible even for us to fall back into this, you know, cultural habitual going for refuge, as it were. Secondly, there's provisional going for refuge, and here someone is beginning to really practice, or at least they're starting to really practice, or seeing the desirability of actually committing themselves to the three jewels. They're beginning to see the refuges as refuges. They might recognize they're not quite ready to fully commit themselves yet to the refuges, but they want to be in that position. So they begin to train for that. So Sangharakshita has said that the level of provisional going for refuge is the level of a mitra and someone preparing for ordination. I'm going to come back to this a little later. Then thirdly, there's effective going for refuge. In the original lecture, Bhante did say that the terms he was using for these different levels and stages are not entirely satisfactory. It's very important to bear that in mind. He'd obviously thought about these different levels, you know, quite a bit, but the terminology was kind of the best he could do, if you like. And perhaps this is especially the case with effective going for refuge. So put it in single inverted commas. Because, you know, sometimes people who've asked for ordination say to order members, my going for refuge is effective. My practice is effective. I'm sure everybody here, your practice is effective to you. It's, in a sense, it's having effects. You're becoming a better person through practicing the Dharma and so on. It's having results. So then, of course, the question goes, so it's effective. Why am I not ordained? Why don't you ordain me? And you can see, as an order member, that yes, there are effects. Things are happening. But you still don't think that they're ready. So clearly, effective has a special sort of meaning in our context. And I want to go into that a little later on. So just hold that thought. So whatever, effective going for refuge really means that you make a definite commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You take that step for life. Have no doubts about taking that step. You're fully committed to the three jewels. This is it. And of course, this is what ordination in Western Buddhist order is all about. Ordination is the witnessing, the direct seeing. You know, a term like witnessing has the it's not just the connotation of seeing, but also of saying, this is true. This is what's actually happening. This is really taking place. It's a very powerful word, witness. And so the order are saying, yes, you are indeed doing that. And one of the reasons why it's effective going for refuge, of course, is that you want your going for refuge to be witnessed by a community that you respect and perhaps even revere in some way. I'm going to come back a bit more to unpacking the meaning of effective a bit later, but that's the basic meaning. And then there's real going for refuge. This is the going for refuge of the stream entrant. It's real because the stream entrant cannot turn back. Spiritual development is irreversible. In other words, another way of putting it, going for refuge is not dependent on conditions. Effective going for refuge is dependent on conditions. One of the signs, in a way, that of effective going for refuge is that the person has a keen awareness of the conditioned nature of their going for refuge. Internal conditions, in the sense of, you know, creating those and putting themselves in the context of external conditions. So it's a very important sort of sign when you see that somebody has the nous, you know, to put themselves in conditions that support their spiritual practice, and that they can create the conditions to support their spiritual practice. It's not passivity in relation to external conditions. It's also you can get those conditions going within yourself, and you have the awareness and the motivation to do that. But with real going for refuge, it's going to happen. It's there. It's established. It's not dependent on anything that's going on. Even if your body is falling to bits, you're still going for refuge. It's not even dependent on that. It's real because the stream entrant sees things as they really are. And fifthly, there's ultimate going for refuge. This occurs with the attainment of enlightenment. And Bhante just says of this level, and I'll just leave you with his words on this level. On this level, one does not go to any outside refuge, but is one's own refuge. In fact, on this level, there is neither inside nor outside, neither self nor other. So perhaps you can ask your study group leader what that means tomorrow. And then sixthly and finally, there's the cosmic going for refuge, which isn't really a level, Bhante said. What Bhante is referring to here is the evolutionary process. And I'm just going to give you a little quote. Each form of life aspires to develop into a higher form. This might sound impossibly poetic, but it is what one, in fact, sees. Yes, I'm going to say a bit more about the cosmic going for refuge, or rather I'm going to quote something that he says about it a bit more tomorrow. I won't say any more about that. So that's a rough sketch of the levels. And what's interesting about this teaching of the levels of going for refuge, I think what it makes it very clear is that going for refuge isn't a sort of fixed stage. One of the great insights of this, it isn't even just a sort of ceremony. It's a way of indicating deepening levels of spiritual commitment. And with cosmic going for refuge here is the key to the mystery of existence itself. So it indicates deepening levels of commitment and transition in spiritual life, and is even the key to the mystery of existence itself. But what about the great stages of the spiritual path? How do they fit in? Let's come to that teaching. So, first of all, what are they? Well, the first great stage is the stage of integration. Secondly, there's the stage of positive emotion. Thirdly, the stage of vision or spiritual death. Fourthly, the stage of transformation or spiritual rebirth. And fifthly, the stage of spontaneous, compassionate activity. So when Bhante first spoke of these five things that people need to do in their spiritual life, what's really needed, he said they correspond in principle to a very traditional teaching which pervades all schools of Buddhism, both of the non-Mahayana, sometimes designated the Hinayana, and the Mahayana schools. And this is the teaching called the Five Paths, a very, very ubiquitous and famous teaching of the Five Paths. And each stage is described as a path, which is very significant, as a marga, not just as a stage or as a step, but as a marga, a path, which I think is very, very suggestive, that we think of the name stage suggests something perhaps a bit static, that you're sort of standing around waiting for the next stage to sort of happen. But each stage itself is a path. It's something dynamic, in movement. It's not itself fixed. The five paths, actually, if you look up the five paths expounded by Vasubandhu and all the great sort of scholars that follow, are so complex. I mean, you actually even start wondering what difference is between each stage. I mean, there's so much going on. They kind of chuck the proverbial metaphysical kitchen sink into each stage, and which reflects the sort of scholastic obsessions of monastic Buddhism. And so, as he often does, Bhante just extracts the sort of essence of the matter, the principle of what's happening, by just paying attention to the names of each of the stages of the path. We'll see how that works in a minute. So let's go through these great stages, and when we've done that, we'll try to relate them to the levels of going for refuge. I know this could sound terribly theoretical. It's not, actually. There's some very important practical points, so please don't switch off and think we're just having a sort of excursion into sort of levels and stages, and we've got here Western Buddhist scholasticism. It really isn't like that. Actually, we're getting down to some real practicalities right now, in fact. Let's deal with the first stage of integration. In the teachings of the five paths, the first stage is called the Sambara Marga, the path of accumulation, or the path of gathering, which is very expressive, because the first thing we need to do is pull ourselves together. We need to integrate all of our disparate energies into some sort of focus. So the primary practices at this stage, or the primary practice to bring about integration, is mindfulness. And of course, the classic meditation here is the mindfulness of breathing. And in life, the different teachings on mindfulness and awareness. My particular favourite is Sangharakshita's Four Dimensions of Awareness. So awareness of things, the external world, nature, and so on. Awareness of self, which is awareness of the body and its movements, thoughts, feelings, emotions, awareness of others, and awareness of reality itself. You know, it's probably a whole path in itself. I mean, probably if you did all that lot, you wouldn't need anything else, but never mind. And then there's the other aspect of mindfulness, which is very important, is having a sense of purpose. Buddhist expositions, classic Buddhist expositions of mindfulness, you get sati samprajanya. So mindfulness and purposiveness, you could even translate it as. So very often mindfulness is spoken of as being in the moment, being aware of what is happening right now, which of course is very important. But there's much more to it than that. You also need to see how the moment connects with the next moment and the moment after that. Not in a neurotic way, but because that's the flow of life. You know, it's not just the power of now, it's the power of then, because now goes. And then you also need to be mindful of your overall purpose in life, your ideals, your values. So you've got to sort of connect up all these sort of different dimensions. So purpose is very important too, being mindful of purpose. It's very, very hard to make spiritual progress if your energies and your attention is dispersed and scattered. So we need to start pulling ourselves together, drawing ourselves together through the practice of mindfulness. And that's why the mindfulness of breathing and all mindfulness teachings are so extraordinarily important. Very interesting, you know, when sometimes, you know, people would talk to Bhante about, you know, what was needed for greater sort of spiritual development and going deeper in meditation. And he'd say, mindfulness, we could be a lot more mindful. And everybody nodded. He said, yes, and I mean mindful about things like closing the door quietly rather than banging it. I mean mindfulness in the sense of not smashing cups. There seem to be a lot of cups smashed here in the community. Or mindfulness about turning out the lights before you leave the room. Mindfulness of turning up on time when you make an appointment with somebody. And, you know, we were all sort of a bit like that. But, you know, he's right. You know, it's you can get have very up there kind of ideas of mindfulness. But actually, you've got to start looking at those very, very basic sort of human aspects of mindfulness. But anyway, the basic point here is drawing ourselves together, creating a harmonious being, moving in a particular direction, gathering ourselves together. Second stage is positive emotion. In the teaching of the five paths, this is the prayoga marga. And prayoga means something like energetic effort. And there's a particular stage in the prayoga marga, which is generating heat, the generation of heat. It's a sort of spiritual experience, it seems, very important one. So you can see why Bhante sees this stage as the stage of positive emotion. In this stage, we develop, we cultivate intensely positive emotions. We develop metta, you know, very important, metta bhavana. Sangharakshita himself said that metta is a hot emotion, not a cool emotion, although without the fever of passion and attachment. So metta, karuna, mudita, upeksha, in other words, the Brahma Viharas, together with reverence, faith, devotion, as well as emotions such as generosity, you know, generosity of spirit, gratitude, and so on. So important to develop positive emotions, to be working on that, because as Sangharakshita pointed out years ago, it's our emotions that drive us, that move us. We're not motivated and sustained by abstract ideas, but by emotion. So it's vitally important that we develop positive, skillful, creative emotion. In his lecture on the system of meditation all those years ago, Sangharakshita said, I'd go so far as to say that there is no spiritual development without positive emotion. No spiritual development without positive emotion. He said, I'd put it as strongly as that. So the main meditation here is metta bhavana and the other Brahma Vihara meditations. Puja is a very important practice here. Spiritual friendship is a very important practice here. The enjoyment of nature is a very important practice here. And participation in the arts and appreciation of the arts. As long as it all is to stimulate positive emotion. So these are the first two great stages of the spiritual path, and we enter them in the FWBO very early on. In our beginners classes, we teach mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana, so people are sort of, you know, getting that stage early. Regulars classes, you'll have mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, puja. Mitra study classes, retreats, everything that we teach really is to develop these great foundations of the spiritual path, these first two great stages. Integration, gathering ourselves together, developing mindfulness, concentration, a sense of purpose, becoming an aware individual, and then positive emotion, becoming a positive, loving, kind, joyous, helpful, energetic, creative, friendly, and so on. And also developing a reverence, a feeling for the spiritual ideals. That will start to happen, the jewels even starting to see them as refugees. So these are great stages, these first two stages. They might sound, you know, it sounds so prosaic, integration, positive emotion, but they cover so much wonderful spiritual practice. So if you prefer the name Sambara and Prayoga, well, fine. But integration, positive emotion. Also included in these great stages, of course, is the practice of ethics, the precepts, becoming a responsible individual. That's all part of this. Interestingly enough, the word sati in Pali can also mean conscience. Sometimes mindfulness can be sort of presented as sort of almost ethically neutral. You're just sort of observing, but that is very far from what the Buddhist tradition says about mindfulness. Mindfulness is an ethical term. It's conscience. It's a clear awareness of the ethical implications of any activity. You've also got the term apramada, which is very close to mindfulness, which is sort of vigilance. And of course, metta is strongly ethical. So the precepts, the ethical dimension is important too. So there's a lot to these stages, and of course they never go away. We never leave them. Never leave them behind. They're taken up into the further stages of the path. And if we're floundering, it's always good to go back. You know, if we're stuck, go back to mindfulness. Go back to metta. If you're getting into something else. Go back to Shila, go back to Dana, you know, go back to ethics, go back to generosity. Now, another way of looking at these stages, and a very traditional way of looking at them, is to see them in terms of the accumulation of punya, the punya sambara. There's that word sambara again, the accumulation of punya. Punya, you probably know, is usually translated as merit, as in transference of merit. And self-surrender. And the idea is, it can be, when you have a word like merit, it's like all your skillful actions, generate sort of merit tokens, which get deposited in the cosmic merit bank, which at a certain point you can sort of cash in for a blissful experience, you know. And, it is unfortunately taken quite literally like that in the East. I mean, Bhante, when he was in India years and years ago, told this story of a Jain ascetic who spent most of his life in fearsome asceticism, who then decided that he wanted to go into business, so sold his merit for a huge sum of money and became a businessman. I don't think it quite works like that. So it's much better to think of punya in different ways. It's much more like positive spiritual momentum. That's the way I think of it. What you're doing with integration and positive emotion, you're developing through the generation of skillful states, you're generating that positive spiritual momentum through things like generosity, you know, through putting yourself into environments where the best in you is drawn out, where you sort of do it even though you might not feel like doing it, as it were. You're developing momentum, a positive spiritual momentum. In Buddhist iconography, the punya sambara is the body aura of the deity, the great glow around the deity. You can see it on the Padmasambhava and the Vajrasattva, and I suppose the yellow squares are the sort of body aura here. In you can see it quite strongly on some paintings. So it's this great glow, and of course it's much bigger than the aura around the head, which is the jnana sambara, the accumulation of knowledge or transcendental awareness, which is perhaps quite significant. You know, that you need a lot of punya, not a lot of wisdom, in a way. I don't know what that means, but anyway. Traditionally, the paramita teachings of the Bodhisattva path, the first five paramitas are the Bodhisattva's accumulation of punya. He develops a tremendous spiritual momentum so that he can really be of benefit to others in all sorts of ways. And of course, that will also support his development of wisdom, which is the final paramita. I was also thinking, looking at our Shakyamuni, the one Aloka painted here, that perhaps the Buddha's body down below represents the accumulation of punya. You know, that very earthed, you know, sort of base which supports the, you know, the golden glow as you move upwards, and supports the sort of movement within. You know, that it's the punya has this sort of idea. It's the sort of, you know, the body momentum of your practice, if you like, the body of the practice, the base of your practice. You could even call it perhaps the healthy human basis, which is generated through skillful, positive, wholesome endeavour and action. And it also corresponds, the accumulation of punya in the context of meditation, to the attainment of shamatha, which is usually translated as calm. Shamatha bhavana really means the cultivation, the development of an intensely positive, calm, highly concentrated, integrated and greatly expanded consciousness. The dhyanas represent shamatha. And on the basis of that, you develop prajna or wisdom. Sometimes people try to ignore this accumulation of punya and shamatha and dhyana, and sort of dismiss it as unimportant. You just go straight to insight. But I think the danger with that approach is that you end up with head Buddhism. Your idea of wisdom is actually, you know, nicely illuminated ideas. Punya means that you've got the possibility of what you reflect on in the Dharma actually really sticking and transforming your being. So if you want body Buddhism, Buddhism in the body, accumulate punya. So so concentrating on integration and positive emotion in all these different aspects, we're developing this very positive spiritual momentum. And this is key at the stage of provisional going for refuge, coming back to our levels of going for refuge. Especially so when you are a man or a woman indeed who has asked for ordination, when you're training for ordination. This accumulation of spiritual momentum is crucial to your training for ordination. It's crucial after ordination, believe you me. But you know, that in a way we're focusing on that very strongly. You know, as you know, that's what we want to get across to people, if you like, before ordination. I was thinking about this word provisional in relation to asking for ordination. I know sometimes when people hear these terms, they go, well, I'm being a bit patronised. You know, you're effective, I'm provisional. It's not like that. It really isn't like that. I was thinking that it's a bit like the old monastic tradition in the West and probably the East as well. And again, I'm going to use a term that might sound very unfortunate in the modern context. In the old monastic tradition, you had the stage of the probationer. On probation, it's not the right word, is it? But the probationer, meaning it meant somebody actually training for full ordination. They wanted it. So they have to train for it. There's something they have to do. It's not just given. And I think that you know, when you're in that stage, you're trying out, you know, what it's like. You're seeing, you want to be ordained. You want to do that, but you're also trying out. There's also perhaps in your mind, do I want to do that? And you're also getting into the habit of the practices, you know, which you need to make going for refuge effective, and to make not just even beyond that, to make effective going for refuge real. So, you know, you're trying things out when you've asked for ordination. You're testing the order, and the order is testing you as well. There's a sort of mutual trying and testing in the spirit of, you know, friendliness and understanding and a desire on your part to effectively go for refuge, on our part wanting you to effectively go for refuge. And that's, you know, that's why we offer the training. And so I say the particular focus is on integration and positive emotion and this accumulation of punya. So it's really important in your ordination training to really get to grips with mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, the other brahmaviharas. There's the Anapanasati retreat that's done as well. That's really good practice for the development of mindfulness. And of course, when you enter ordination training, much more opens up. I've talked about special practices. And you're doing one of them on this very retreat, the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice. Sangha Rajta offered that practice in response to people training for ordination. When we started to do the Going for Refuge retreats here, the ordination training retreats, we started to do prostrations. And Sangha Rajta responded, seeing the interest in that, by composing that refuge tree, seeing that refuge tree, and giving us a practice, you know, which actually we all do in the order. But it came out of the desire of men, you know, to be ordained. So it's a special practice in relation to men training for ordination. Although, as I say, it's practiced afterwards as well, after you're ordained. And this practice is amazing, because what you're doing in the practice is integrating around the refuges, body, speech and mind, focusing fully on the refuges. And the aim of the practice, one of the aims, it's an extraordinarily rich practice, which, you know, you'd probably go all the way with, all the way to enlightenment. But the aim is to draw everything, all of us, into the act of going for refuge. So it's not just, you know, the mindfulness as an integration as we usually understand it. It's integration around our highest values. So that's a special practice that opens up when you ask for ordination. And then there's special retreats like this one. You know, this training and testing that goes on. Is it really what you want? Is the order, what is this order? What is it all about? What is the spiritual path, and so on? And then thirdly, there's the order itself. When you ask for ordination, the order comes to meet you. You've said, I want to be with you. I want to be part of this. I'm serious about this. And the order responds. We take every request for ordination very, very seriously. We take you seriously. So we move towards you. And of course, particular connections will develop. And, you know, you can have Kalyana Mitras, you know, two order members who become, you know, your spiritual friends, eventually looking towards asking for a private preceptor. You might be helping order members in Dharma work. So this is quite a stage that you're in. And it's all to do with the sort of development of this very strong positive spiritual momentum. So that, you know, when you are ordained, you know, it's already sort of happening almost before the ordination ceremony happens. That's just putting a seal, if you like, on what's there. And you can really make the most of what comes after ordination. So, yes, these first two great stages, and the stage of, you know, whatever we want to call it, you know, the special stage of people training for ordination is there might be all sorts of ups and downs, but you're developing this very strong spiritual momentum. Integration and positive emotion, sambara and prayoga, gathering and energetic effort. So let's move now to the third great stage. And this stage actually only really opens up when you make a serious spiritual commitment, when you effectively go for refuge. I should just point out, I'm assuming the path of regular steps. Of course, human beings aren't like that, and you might have had glimpses of something way ahead, but you have to go back and regularise that. But anyway, let's just stay with this. So, yes, the next stage really opens up in our tradition of training. When you make a serious spiritual commitment, when you effectively go for refuge. Because the next stage is the stage of vision or spiritual death. In this stage, we move towards seeing things as they really are directly. On the basis of that highly positive, concentrated, integrated state, that positive momentum, that shamatha, we begin to look deeply into the nature of existence, the heart of things. We might have done some preliminary work on this in the first two stages. We will have, through study and reflecting on the Dharma. Maybe we've even taken through some guided meditations on the Nidana chain, for example. But at this stage, we go right into a systematic meditation on the nature of existence. And in our tradition, we only start to meditate like this on our ordination retreats. In other words, when you're deemed ready to be ordained, when order members are fully confident that you're effectively going for refuge. So the great practice here is the contemplation of the six elements. We meditate on the fact that all the elements, earth, water, fire, air, space and consciousness, that make us up are in fact borrowed from the elements and they'll be taken away at death. So we give them up now, including consciousness. We give that up as well. I'm going to just read you a poem of Sangharakshita's, which will give you some feeling for this meditation. It's called The Six Elements Speak. I am earth. I am rock, metal, and soil. I am that which exists in you as bone, muscle, and flesh. But now I must go, leaving you light. Now we must part. Goodbye. I am water. I am ocean, lake, rivers, and streams. The rain that falls from clouds and the dew on the petals of flowers. I am that which exists in you as blood, urine, sweat, saliva, and tears. But now I must go, leaving you dry. Now we must part. Goodbye. I am fire. I come from the sun, travelling through space to sleep in wood, flint, and steel. I am that which exists in you as bodily heat, the warmth of an embrace. But now I must go, leaving you cold. Now we must part. Goodbye. I am air. I am wind, breeze, and hurricane. I am that which exists in you as the breath in your nostrils, in your lungs, the breath that gently comes, that gently goes. But now I must go for the last time, leaving you empty. Now we must part. Goodbye. I am space. I contain all. From a grain of dust to a galaxy, I am that which exists in you as the space limited by the earth, water, fire, and air that make up your physical being. But now they have all gone, and I must go too, leaving you unlimited. Now we must part. Goodbye. I am consciousness. Indefinable and indescribable. I am that which exists in you as sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and thought. And now I must go. From the space no longer limited by your physical being, leaving nothing of you, there is no one from whom to part, so no goodbye. Earth dissolves into water. Water dissolves into fire. Fire dissolves into air. Air dissolves into space. Space dissolves into consciousness. Consciousness dissolves into whom? So I think you get a feel for what you're doing in that meditation. And I think from hearing that poem, you probably get the sense of why it's really important that you need the preparation of integration and positive emotion, why you need the momentum, the spiritual momentum, why you need the punya sambara, why you need spiritual commitment. Because in this practice, you are giving up, you are giving away yourself. Positive though you are, you're wonderful though you are, you're giving it all up and giving it away, because that's the way of things. You don't actually own and possess anything. So you're entering the stage of spiritual death. Death, says Bhante, is the best translation of shunyata. Forget emptiness, voidness, open dimension of being, etc., etc. The best translation is death, because shunyata means the death of everything conditioned. Your spiritual death. As the Zen masters and the Sufi masters say, die before you die. And you don't just do this six-element practice on your ordination retreat. Sangharakshita has said that all order members should be doing this practice regularly after they're ordained. And going on retreat, especially, to do this practice systematically and keeping alive the vision, that open-ended dimension of things. Because spiritual death doesn't happen sort of just once. It's something that should be constant. But spiritual death isn't the last word. Because the next stage is the stage of transformation, or the stage of spiritual rebirth. So at the time of ordination, you're not only taught how to meditate on the elements and how to die spiritually, you're also introduced to a Buddha or Bodhisattva. In your private ordination, where you're alone with your private preceptor, he gives you a mantra of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And later he'll teach you, according to your temperament and your particular needs, how to actually meditate on that mantra. It might be a simple mantra recitation, or it might involve a more or less elaborate visualization of the Buddha or Bodhisattva and sensing the presence of that transcendental form. The Buddha or the Bodhisattva is beautiful, sublime. It's very important in the early stages, especially of these practices, that you concentrate on the beauty of the figure, for obvious reasons, because you want to be drawn, you know, towards the figure, and you want them to draw towards you. But as Sangharakshita has said, sublime though the Buddha or Bodhisattva is that you've taken, you know, sitting there on his or her wonderful lotus throne above your head or in the space in front of you, sublime though they are, it is you. You, as you will be if you die, if you spiritually die, it's you transformed. So in this meditation, you're meditating on what you will be, what you will become. So this stage is therefore the stage of transformation, because in meditating on a figure like this, the whole aim is that your whole life is transformed. And it's why order members should, I'm using the word should quite deliberately, meditate daily on their desired Buddha or Bodhisattva and do retreats devoted to their Buddha or Bodhisattva and give it time and attention. Because what you're doing is you're meditating on what is deepest, and you're meditating on your ultimate aim. And as I said the other day, it becomes a kind of myth and symbol, if you like, that leads to the transformation of your whole life. So that's the fourth stage. And then the fifth stage is spontaneous compassionate activity. So all these stages are leading to this: becoming a naturally loving and compassionate being. That's what a Buddha or Bodhisattva is: a naturally loving and compassionate being. Naturally wise, naturally loving, naturally compassionate. Completely unself-conscious about that. Active in the world, spontaneously bringing the Dharma to others, because that's the only thing to possibly do. It's the natural expression of what you are. I mean, that amazing reading we had of the Buddha the other night, that description of his behaviour, that's, you know, the spontaneous compassionate activity. This is lila, play, lalita, sport. Sahaja, naturalness. It's joyous, naturally spontaneous, compassionate activity. In the Zen ox herding pictures, I really love the last picture. It's called Going into the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. And the whole, everything that's evoked is of an old Chan traveller, an old Zen traveller, just naturally, what does it say, without having to perform miracles, trees suddenly, bare trees suddenly burst into bloom, you know, just naturally communicating with people and joyously bringing them to the Dharma. Well, we'll say a bit more about this stage tomorrow. So that's the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity. Just to say something about these five stages, so we've looked at them sort of sequentially, but Sangharakshita has also said that there's something that we can look for in our practice daily. He said, you know, every day, have a look at what you've done in the day. I think he said this. You know, maybe, is that, well, I'm saying it. so it's my words. He did say that. Thank you, Surita. So thanks, Bhante. I knew it was a good idea. So every day, ask yourself, have I practiced mindfulness? Have I been pulling my energies together? You know, have I been dispersed? Have I been developing positive emotion? Have I been developing loving kindness? Or have I been a really miserable, you know, etc. Person? You know, unhelpful, blah, blah, blah. Have I contacted my vision today? You know, have I contacted what is highest or deepest? You know, have I been in touch with that today? Have I been transforming my life in relation to that vision, out of that vision, in the light of that vision? And have I been spontaneously compassionate? Have I been actually sort of unselfconsciously benefiting others, joyously, joyously happy to be doing what I'm doing and being a Dharma practitioner and benefiting others? So ask yourself that question in each day, because those five things lead to a very effective spiritual life. They also relate, you know, for those who are interested in these matters, to the five spiritual faculties. So integration, mindfulness, positive emotion, faith, vision, wisdom, transformation, meditation, and spontaneous compassionate activity, energy, for the scholars amongst you. But let's come back to effective going for refuge. So I said earlier that by effective going for refuge, we mean it in a special sense. In Bhante's original lecture on the levels of going for refuge, when he spoke about effective going for refuge, he referred especially to what are known in Vajrayana Buddhism, Tantric Buddhism, as the esoteric or secret refuges. The wonderful evocation of the meaning of the secret refuges. And first of all, he said by secret, the word is guhya in Sanskrit, which can mean the cave of the heart as well as secret. He was saying that, look, the word secret doesn't mean they're sort of being kept away from people. You know, this is our secret, you know. It's not like that. It's because these refuges, the refuges in this context, are an experience, are about direct experience. He said Vajrayana, Tantric Buddhism, is nothing other than direct experience. It's nothing to do with books and theories and philosophies and the stuff you can get off the shelves. It's to do with direct experience. And he said, when you're talking about experience, especially spiritual experience, it's very, very difficult to communicate what's really going on. So the secret refuges are the refuges experienced on a deep, subtle, direct level. That's why they're secret. And the secret refuges in the Vajrayana tradition are the guru, the yidam, that's the chosen deity, and the dharkani, or spiritual companion. I'm not going to dwell too much on these, but I better say something. So the Vajrayana sort of put it like this. So you don't have a direct experience of Buddha Shakyamuni. He entered Parinirvana 2,500 years ago. You don't have contact with the Dharmakaya or the Sambhogakaya. So where are you going to have your experience of enlightenment, the Buddha? It's going to be in your teacher, in the person who's more spiritually experienced than you. He's going to be your direct experience of the Buddha. And also because he gives the Dharma for you, that you actually need. And then when it comes to the secret Dharma refuge, that's the chosen deity. Well, the point they make here is that, look, the Dharma's vast. There's 84,000 Dharma skandhikas or Dharma heaps. How can you know any of those, or, you know some of them, or have a direct experience of them? So But you can have a direct experience of an image, a symbol, speaking directly to your heart, which is indicating your path given to you by your teacher. And as for the Sangha refuge, well, the Sangha, again, the Arya Sangha is distant. The Sangha around you, well, there's so many of them. So what's your direct experience? It's the Dharkani. And the Dharkani here is the spiritual companion, the spiritual friend who sparks you off very, very strongly. So you're kind of impelled to really practice the Dharma. And he says, well, the Dharkani isn't really outside you. It's not something that isn't located in a person. It's something that arises, the spark of inspiration that arises between spiritual friends. It's the love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, faith, devotion, and this spiritual charge that arises between spiritual friends. So why did Bhante mention these tantric refuges in the context of effective going for refuge? Because we're not a Vajrayana movement. You know, we might get inspiration from figures like Padmasambhava, but we're not a Vajrayana movement. And I think the reason why he mentioned these secret refuges is because it was a way of talking about what happens when you effectively go for refuge. A way of putting that, perhaps, is that the refuges, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, are universal ideals. What's happening in effective going for refuge is that those universal ideals are becoming particular, concrete, and they're being experienced vividly and directly in a way that's actually transforming your life here and now. So when you effectively go for refuge, you're not a sort of general Buddhist, as it were, with the refuges at a sort of safe distance, and you're not sort of, you know, dipping around all sorts of Buddhist groups. The refuges are becoming vivid, alive in your life, here and now. That sense of the sublime, the profound, the transcendent is there, but it's becoming concrete in your day-to-day experience. So although the Buddha is indeed the refuge, the ultimate teacher, you've actually decided to follow a specific path of spiritual practice with a particular teacher and with his disciples. And of course, in the Western Buddhist order, Sangharakshita is our teacher, although he really doesn't like the label guru. By teacher, he means that the Western Buddhist order is founded on his elucidation of the Dharma, his translation of the Dharma. So that's why he's there on the refuge tree. It's not megalomania on his part, or a personality cult. It's just that, you know, we practice following his teaching, as it were. He's our way in to the refuge tree, and he is the founder of our order. And we're practicing with his disciples or disciples of his disciples. And we practice his system of practice, like the one I've described earlier. Actually, there's a lot more in his system of practice. I mean, we could have looked at it in terms of the 10 precepts, which is the ethical code that he recommends. So we practice in Sangharakshita's order. We're the community he has inspired, and we're following its particular practices and traditions. And with particular people, an expanding community of people, but particular people who spark one another off. And we're doing this in this way to support an ever-deepening going for refuge, a never-ending going for refuge. The ordination we take is the Dharmachari ordination. So Dharmachari can be translated as Dharma-farer, or one who courses in the Dharma, and that never comes to an end. But you have to start by doing something specific. So it's very important that you realise this. The Western Buddhist Order and the FWBO are not a sort of umbrella Buddhist order where anything sort of goes, so to speak. You know, we can have a bit of this and a bit of that, and we can bring in these teachers and those teachers. That's not what we're about. That's not what we're doing. It's a specific tradition and path, which is the same actually with Buddhist orders throughout the entire world. They represent particular system of training and practice that's distinctive but leading to the universal refuges. It's very important that you get this. I don't want to be rude. If you don't want that, If you're not sure of that, that's okay. But I advise you not to pursue ordination into the Western Buddhist Order. If you think it's something else, a sort of umbrella organisation, or something where sort of anything goes, you are in the wrong place. Ordination into the Western Buddhist Order is a very serious affair. It's a joyous affair, actually. I mean, I've had, you know, we have a lot of laughs in the Western Buddhist Order, but it's a deadly serious affair. You know, it's like, we know, we're good followers of Harkwin in that sense. It's life and death serious, you know, but, you know, you've got to be able to kind of, if you'll forgive the expression, Lord, piss yourself laughing, you know, when you need to. Sorry, I couldn't think of another happening. But it is a serious affair. Ordination into the Western Buddhist Order is an initiation, actually. It's an initiation into a mandala. And a mandala, all mandalas, are surrounded by walls of lotuses, vajras, flames and cremation grounds. The mandala is a sacred space where everything is heightened. That's why when you're in a mandala, everything becomes heightened, becomes your spiritual efforts, your individual efforts, even your collective efforts, are heightened and magnified into something incredible. That's why a mandala is so sort of powerful. And the order is such a mandala, actually. People don't often realise this, where everything is really heightened. And that's why you can make real spiritual progress within it. It's very painful if you're in it, and then you realise you don't want to be in it. You begin to start noticing the cremation grounds and the flames. They start pressing in a bit. So be sure that this is what you want, especially in relation to this point, that it's a specific course of spiritual discipline and practice, and the order has particular customs, traditions that you're going to be part of. You don't have to do it. It's fine. You know, nobody's going to feel offended if you say, actually, I don't want this. I don't like the sound of this. That is okay. We can all be amicable about that. But don't come into it and then realise that you don't want it, because it becomes very, very painful for everybody. After ordination, of course, you aim at real going for refuge. You aim at stream entry, which is also can be described as the arising of the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for all beings. You aim your going for refuge, in other words, at seeing things as they really are and cultivating selfless loving kindness for others. You aim your going for refuge at becoming a true friend of the world. You aim your going for refuge at becoming a refuge for others. And we'll look at that especially tomorrow. Thank you.